any psychiatrist, really, psychologist, counselor, will wrestle with this notion of self-esteem, what it is, and how it fits into their work. I remember somebody telling me once, he said, you know, why do people do this sport? You know, why would anybody want to train and expend their skills and energy on the high jump? Because he said, what do they do? All of that practice, he says, you get over the bar, and what's the next thing do they do? They always raise it higher. And then he said, my father was like that. No matter what I did, no matter how hard I tried, no matter how high I jumped for him, he always pushed the bar higher, and I was never good enough. And I've carried that sense of not being good enough inside me all of my life, and it just eats away at my confidence and my self-worth. And there's a kind of a face validity, isn't there, to the idea that our sense of self-worth is really closely linked with our well-being, with flourishing. It's hard to think of how we can flourish where we're nursing a view of our own worth and significance which is downtrodden. And so it's understandable that, you know, half a century ago, as scientific psychology really began to take off 60 years ago, people developed instruments that tried to measure this concept of self-worth, usually by asking questions. And of course, the cleaner, the shorter the instrument, provided you can get the reliability and validity, the better, because if it's short and clean, you can get it out there and do big data sets. And when they hit on the Rosenberg self-esteem inventory, that really gave lift off to the whole field of inquiry, of investigating people's subjective sense of self-worth in a 10-point scale and its relationship with human well-being, flourishing. And what did they find? Well, it's really interesting. Lots of studies. In fact, the study of self-esteem, it rose to become one of the top three most studied subjects in the whole field of clinical psychology and experimental psychology over the years. And so a raft of studies have shown really quite significant and consistent correlations between low self-worth and a range of adverse mental health outcomes. And so across mental health, as you would expect, there's a correlation with depression, anorexia nervosa, phobic disorders even. Not only mental health, but beyond mental health to issues that affect all of us, academic achievement, educational achievement, seem to correlate with self-esteem. The stronger your sense of self-worth, the better you did at school. Crime, social deviance, substance misuse. And you can see the enthusiasm rising here, because if this correlation turned out to be causation, and there's a big if there, bit of a spoiler for what's coming next, but if this correlation turned out to be causation, then indeed we had hit the jackpot of human flourishing, because we had uncovered a common factor which seemed to be closely linked to a range of adverse outcomes causally, and therefore, having identified that factor, if we can treat it, or even better, vaccinate against it, with the notion of a social vaccine, as they did in California eventually, by getting into schools, raising self-esteem, then potentially the outcome across a raft of these indicators could be massive. And so you can see why the governor of California set up a whole self-esteem project and indeed invented the notion of social vaccine and rolled it out across the schools of California. But sadly, what's happening at this point is, as often the case, our enthusiasm for correlation is leading us to get ahead of ourselves before anybody really gets down to the hard work, the more careful studies of establishing whether this is causation. But the prospects, the potential prize seemed so big, people couldn't contain themselves. And off the hare ran, and on, as it embedded itself through popular psychology, pop psychology, into popular culture. And in a way, the logic is impeccable. If low self-esteem is the problem, then boosting self-esteem is the solution. Boosterism. You take a dose of this thing. You boost up your sense of self-worth. And of course, in its popular form, in its simplest, most marketable form, which had a huge effect across the states, particularly in a more subtle but actually really quite pervasive way here as well, as it begins to take off, then it really does begin to impact on culture. And so the self-esteem movement begins to market these slogans, boosterism, aimed at helping people practice the process of boosting one's sense of self. And these are cards that you can pretty much download from the National Self-Esteem Movement in America, where you can meditate on these self-positive self-statements over your lunch break. And if you're of a religious turn of mind, you can get a bib and recruit God to the cause of boosterism, where it says, "I may be little, but to God I'm big stuff." And so the whole cult almost of "I'm special," and remember, special is a big thing to bring a kid into the world as being. Now, you know, my grandkids, they're special to me. They're absolutely special to me. They're not only unique, but they're my grandkids. They're really, really special, just as yours will be to you. But do we really want them to grow up thinking that they're going to be special to everybody else as well? Because that's what this kind of thinking does. Because special is unique with a twist of greatness. It's not about fitting in. Now, fitting in actually is a really important skill. It's more about standing out, being above. And one can see why in this culture we begin to worry about the growth of narcissism, but more about that later. But certainly every day, millions of people, as a result of the penetration of the self-esteem movement in its popular form, cross-culture, certainly in North America, go around rehearsing these positive self-statements every day. One study found that over 50% of survey respondents said that they frequently use these kind of self-affirmations. Only 3% said that they never use them. And so we can see how self-esteem becomes the holy grail of mental health. And this is something called an engram, which you've probably come across before, the Google Books Engram Viewer. And what this does is it graphs the occurrence of a particular word in a corpus of books published between 1800 and the present. It's a very rough and ready sort of snapshot of how often a word is occurring in a culture, at least as we find it written in its books. It's an interesting thing. You might want to Google it when you get home. But if you look at the Google Engram for self-control, you can see how people were talking and thinking about self-control right through the Victorian era and then on through the Self-World War into the 30s, and then it began to fall into the 40s, 50s, 60s. There was a new kid on the block in the 50s, 60s, and this is the word self-esteem as it began to occur in our literature. It's begun to tail off again after the year 2000 for reasons that we'll return to. But as you can see, that people are much less interested in self-control now and more interested in self-esteem. And the penetration of the self-esteem movement in popular culture is, you can sort of index it in all kinds of ways. This is the publications in major news outlets that mention or that are about self-esteem, popular articles. And you can see once again how the growth of this cultural phenomenon through the 1980, 85, 1995, 2005, the interest in this. And I used to have a Google alert which will tell you, it scans all the news every day and drops into your inbox a list of all the articles with self-esteem, and on it goes. Facebook's bad for your self-esteem. This is good for your self-esteem. Don't do this, it's bad for your self-esteem, but if you do that, that's good. And on it goes, because of course we're all interested in this question of significance. How much am I worth? It certainly seemed to be having some impact, if not on mental health, as I'll come onto in a moment. It certainly seems to have been affecting the way we think about ourselves. Over the last four decades, there's some evidence. These data are always sort of questionable, but there's some evidence that our views of ourselves, as the self-esteem movement, its influence grew in culture, our views have been becoming consistently more favorable. And so Jean Twenge, Twenge and Campbell's book on narcissism is a very good read. And this was published in peer refereed journals, it's not in the book, but she was able to track by pulling together data sets over several decades, standardizing them as far as she could, qualifying her findings as much as she could, but she was able to track the rise of various ways of how students rate their abilities. And this is the proportion rating their abilities above average, you see. And so this is the drive to achieve above average. And so you've got 75% of students think their drive to achieve is above the average. You don't need to be a mathematician to work out here. Intellectual self-confidence. Look at it, down 1965, languishing down here, 40%. But, you know, by 2009, we're up to 60% rate the intellectual self-confidence above average. And leadership ability, on it goes, you see, above average. Now, we mustn't make the same error. Correlation doesn't mean causation. So there is a correlation between the cultural penetration of the self-esteem movement, indicated by all of these magazine articles, newspaper articles, Engram, and so on. There's a correlation between that and these rather more consistently favorable views of oneself. That's quite a compelling correlation, but we can't really know whether the one has caused the other or whether they're both being produced by some underlying cultural factor. But what I've tried to do in this opening section is to stand back and just survey the ground a bit in terms of what's been going on, particularly with the self-esteem movement. What I'm going to do now, is, before going on to the next section, is break for some discussion or questions, and it may be we'll find that most of what you want to ask, I'm just about to try and answer. But I'd love to hear your comments. I'd love to work with you a bit on this, see what you think, and so please do chip in. If you could just shout, I think that's the only thing. Oh, you've got a mic. Anyone want to chip in? Yes.
I was just wondering, on your students' graph of who's above average, was the question, are you above average for students, or could it have been they were perceiving against the whole population?
Yeah, this was against other students. Yep.
I was just wondering, what do you think started the self-esteem movement?
Excuse me?
What do you think started the self-esteem
movement? That's a great question, actually. It's a great question. Anyone got any ideas? Well, I have a think about it. Anyone got any ideas? What in a way started all of this? It's an interesting question, isn't it? You know, it's a kind of a cultural critique. I think I put my finger on two things. What one is the consumerism of post-war generation. What the post-war prosperity did was, for the first time in history, it put lots of new money into the pockets of young people and people like me. And I can remember the sense of cultural change over that time, accompanied by consumerism, which marketed to me. The Mad Men of the 60s, they're interested in young people because we were the young people getting the new money, suddenly the disposable income. And this gave us a sense of independence and a sense of opportunity to differentiate ourselves from the past, from the elders. And, you know, add to that the growing way that prosperity was enabling us to go to university. We're becoming much more socially mobile, less connected into our communities and into our families. And you can see how consumerism fed into the rise of individualism. An individualism which says that if you want to understand reality, the meaning of life, look inside yourself. You decide. It's what you think. And there were lots of cultural indicators of this, I think. I think, look at the picture of the 50s, of the Listen with Mother. The families gathered round the radio, listening with Mother, the 50s family. And there's a great sense of, this is about us, it's we. Not me, it's we together. Now go to the 60s, where I'm walking down the street with a transistor radio. And this is me, mobile, independent, with my radio that I bought that's been marketed to me. And it gives me a whole new sense of self. And so I think this and other factors provided a very fertile soil for psychology to come along and say, feeling good about yourself isn't just nice, it's scientific too, because we've got all these psychologists telling you that feeling good about yourself is good for you. It leads to flourishing. So keep going, you see. So I think we've got a coincidence of interest between consumerism and psychology at that time of making this thing work. And then, of course, postmodernism, the philosophical unfolding that was going on at the time. And you could see this whole radical individualism at landing pretty much where we are now, which is that I define reality. If reality doesn't fit how I feel, reality changes. And that takes into a whole other area. But it's very interesting. Yes. Isn't that interesting? Yes. So what psychology did was, it said, we've got the answer. For centuries, philosophers have grappled with this huge question, who am I? What is my significance? I stand in the universe and I look around, am I a heap of dust or am I something more than that? And people have grappled with that in all kinds of ways. Psychologists, forget all that. We've got a measuring instrument, and that'll tell you how significant you are. You just add up your answers. And if they're not high enough, we'll help you boost your sense of self-worth. So what psychology is doing is presenting us with a kind of a science which is actually trying to address big philosophical questions. And I think, as we're already beginning to see, it can't. Science can't tell you what your worth is. Anyone else want to pop in or chip in? Okay, should we carry on then? Do a bit more. So, of course, the question is, if you live in a culture in which self-esteem has now become the main road, it's become the holy grail of flourishing, if that's what I'm learning at school, is I need to feel good about myself. I need to find ways of boosting my sense of self-worth, because that's how I'll flourish. How do I do that? Well, there are lots of ways. I want to just discuss three of them with you. The first is with achievement. The more I do, the more I can accomplish, the better I feel. I stake my sense of worth on what I achieve. Now, Johnny Wilkinson, if you remember, his moment of glory was 2001, 26th of November, when about a minute before the end of the game, that famous drop goal, when he won it for England against the Australians, and he became a national treasure overnight because he had achieved. He'd achieved everything that little boy who first went out on to the rugby field at age 8 to long for. He'd achieved. And yet in his book, Tackling Life, he says, within hours of that kick, within hours, I was tumbling out of control. You see, I'm only as good as my last kick. I'm afflicted with a powerful fear of failure, and I didn't know how to free myself on it. And it's, I'm only as good, worthy, valuable, loved as my last kick. But we all know that staking our worth on our last kick only makes us as good as our last kick. But our culture perpetuates the notion that we just keep on trying. And so we market to each other 5 ways to get success, 10 ways to accomplish this particular goal, 4 ways to boost your ref rating, 3 ways to get your esteem indicators. Do they still do that? When I did the RAE, thankfully, quite a while ago now, we had a section called esteem indicators. Don't you think that's interesting? Esteem indicators. And the problem, as Johnny Wilkinson is saying, is that staking your sense of worth on your achievements makes you feel good temporarily. But you're only ever as good as that last achievement. And very quickly, other people are overtaking you. Other people are kicking harder. You're getting older. You got the injury. And you're falling behind. And now who are you? So that's one way we can do it. Another way is through social status and being noticed. Of course, achievement links with this because this is the way to get social status. But having status in a society provides an intoxicating draft of self-worth all of its own. The economist, the father of modern economics, Adam Smith, he wrote in 1798, he said, "To what purpose is all the toil and bustle of this world? What is the end of greed and ambition? Pursuit of wealth and power and preeminence. Why do we do it? What drives us on?" He said, "Is it to supply food and drink and clothes? No, the wages of the poorest labourer can supply them. You can get a pair of jeans from Primark, made in some sweatshop. It doesn't cost you much. We can all get the basic." So what then are the advantages of that great purpose of human life, which we call bettering our condition? What was the answer? To be observed, to be attended to be noticed. Now, this affects us varying degrees. Some of us notably people who stand up here on occasions like this, affected by this drive more than others. But all of us, it's quite important where we fit in. None of us likes to be unnoticed. And so there is something that, to the human spirit, a connection between our sense of significance and worth and being noticed. And it's quite a close connection. The problem, of course, is that other people want to get noticed too. So they are working hard and they're in the pecking order and they want to displace you, and you're getting older and then you will retire. And now who notices you? Who are you? And so once again, the allure of status proves to be shifting sand. It just puts us back onto the treadmill of doing more to stay noticed, to be more noticed. And this, of course, is the problem of contingency. That is staking my sense of self-worth on factors which are contingent, on things that I can't control, and therefore likely to lead to drivenness and the treadmill. So the third way we can do it might help, actually, and this was the solution of the self-esteem movement in its popular form. Because it actually came to us with a correct diagnosis. It said the problem is contingency. If you stake your sense of self-worth on variables that you can't control, you're at the mercy of those contingent variables. You need to stake your self-esteem, your sense of significance and worth, on something more secure. Now, what will that be? You say what your worth is. You declare how much you're significant. You state your value, because no one can take that away from you. And it sounds good, doesn't it? You know, I'm worthy. Just say it. Say to your father who said that to you, I don't care what you said, it's what I think that counts. I'm not jumping anymore. I value myself. And all of us in counseling would recognize that that is an important step in the field, or sorry, on the pathway out of being locked into those negative voices of the past. We have to take responsibility for our feelings. But the self-esteem movement actually is asking us to do something quite interesting. It's asking us to assert our value and worth existentially, without any reference to the big philosophical questions that stand behind it. Now, you may want to come back to me on that and discuss that a bit more, but in its popular form, in popular culture, this is how it panned out. Learning to love yourself, Whitney Houston said, is the greatest love of all. A particularly tragic turn of phrase given how she ended her own life. And so the question is, contingency, or rather non-contingent self-esteem, that I assert, it sounds good, doesn't it? But does it work? Does it work? What do you think? Do you want to chip in? I'd like to hear any more questions or comments at this stage.
Just thinking of, you've been mentioning...
It's all right, yep.
You've been mentioning self-esteem and also self-worth. Do you see a difference between them?
What a great question, yes. Can I just ask, what do you think?
I think there is, definitely.
Yep. Can you unpack that?
And I think from the self-esteem point of view, quite right, it's based on what you do. To me, self-worth is based on an innate worth as a human being. And I wouldn't see anything wrong with having self-worth on that basis. I'm not saying there's something wrong with self-esteem, but I think it's shaky ground.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you've raised a great point, because we have got halfway through a lecture and I haven't defined what I'm talking about, which is quite interesting. So we all thought we were, you know, having a discussion about something. But if I said, let's all write down now what we think we're talking about, we would get different answers. And I purposely held back on the question of definition to illustrate that point, because it's the problem of the whole self-esteem movement, that it's always been poorly defined. Indeed, the most commonly used instrument, the Rosenberg self-esteem scale, is a conflation of two key elements of self-esteem. One is the question of self-worth, you see, and the other is the question of competency, that I'm competent as a person to meet life's challenges. So it's that sense of inner competency. Competent. It doesn't mean I'm good at everything, but I'm competent to rise to life's challenges as best I can. So there's that element, but then there's this more deeper sense of worth, dignity as a human being. Of course, what questions do you construct to measure that? And quite what you're talking about by it is another issue that makes us realize this whole area isn't all that scientific so much as deeply philosophical. These are big questions. What is your dignity as a human being? You're a bunch of chemicals thrown together. That's a philosophical question. Science can't answer the question of dignity. But we were all pretending with the self-esteem movement, particularly because we had the Rosenberg inventory and we had all this data, that we could. But it is staggering and a testimony to our ability as human beings to be swept along, even in science, by the zeitgeist, that this question was not asked in as hard and penetrating a way as it should have been. So you've got, have you heard of Nathaniel Brandon? He's probably the best name. I think Nathaniel Brandon has a lot of good things to say about self-esteem. He'd say, well, it's much more complex than the way you've been caricaturing it. But I've been caricaturing, actually, the way pop psychology caricatures it. And it's pop psychology that's changing the hearts and minds of our kids and of our young people. Love yourself. It's the greatest love of all, you see. So I don't make any apologies for caricaturing. But Nathaniel Brandon would argue that there is a more nuanced, complex understanding of self-esteem around. And he's 1969. Wrote the big text called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. It's a good text. One of the textbooks, in fact. So in many ways, Brandon is the father of the self-esteem psychological experimental movement. But he addressed the International Association of Self-Esteem in 1991. So we're 22 years later, and at the core of his address was the central challenge still facing us is to find a definition of self-esteem that we can all agree on. This is 1991. 2008, and I put it in my book from his blog, he says, the issue we're still grappling with, 2008, this is 40 years plus now since his first book, is that we don't have a definition we can all agree on, you see. And so this is the kind of not only philosophical morass that self-esteem sits in, but also the conceptual confusion that still pervades the whole field. But we all know that notwithstanding that, there's something here that's important, though. I think, as you've rightly said, I think a sense of dignity, a sense of basic worth as to what our value is, it's quite important to flourishing and mental health. I think what we're worrying about now is whether the self-esteem movement is the answer. Do you want to chip in, push back? Any thoughts? Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Where does self-confidence fit in? Because my earthly father worked tremendously hard to empower me to succeed in life. When I became a missionary and I was preaching in situations, dangerous situations, some of them, where the gospel had never been preached before, I still felt confidence. But it wasn't in me, it was in my Heavenly Father. And it always worked out. But,
right.
You know,
yes, well,
confidence is rather important, really.
Yes, in psychological terms, confidence will be relate to this notion of competence, that I have a basic sense of competency in meeting life's challenges. Okay, I'm not saying that's what this competency is. It's a kind of an inner confidence, not that I'm good at everything, but that I can rise to life's challenges, and that was how they tried to define it within psychology. But as you can see, it's just two of the 10 questions of Rosenberg's inventory. The other 8 are all on trying to get at this sense of inner worth. And in fact, Brandon defines it as worth is being worthy of happiness. Now, was Hitler worthy of happiness? We immediately see that there are moral issues here that provide a context to this. We're in a very complex area. Yes, there's another. Yes, please.
What concerns me as a grandmother is the extreme reliance that some of my grandchildren have on Facebook, and their image and their self-esteem seems to be attached to, I suppose it's narcissism and selfie photographs and publishing about themselves things that they want people to hear, and it seems to be based on dreams.
Yes, and you'd like it to be based on something else, wouldn't you? You know, and the question that the self-esteem movement, you can understand, rightly grapples with, is don't, and so it's right in its diagnosis, it says don't attach your sense of worth to these contingent variables, like your last Facebook update or upgrade. Because it's a treadmill, you're always upgrading, and then someone else posts something that looks better. Now you need to re-massage your image. So we do want them. But what is that going to be? The self-esteem movement that was rolled out in some schools, still have a whole school self-esteem policy, would say you've got to say what your worth is. Don't worry about that. You know, it's really important that you love yourself. You value yourself, you say what you're worth. And we're trying to boost kids' sense of their being special in this way. What I'm raising is a question mark. Does it work? Does it work? And if that doesn't work, then what do we do? I suppose that, yes, please.
It seems that an underlying question is what we are comparing ourselves against and how important that comparison is.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Just a simple one. Self-respect is different from self-love, is it not?
How do you see it as being different? Well, I mean, we've all got to do some thinking about this. You know, there's...
Yes. Self-respect is very important, I think, to everybody.
Mm.
But you're implying that self-love is not good.
Well, I'm just raising lots of question marks at the moment.
Yes.
I hope to land a bit more in a few minutes, but I take your point. You're saying, you make an important, you say, hang on a minute, let's differentiate. You've said, let's differentiate self-worth from competency.
Yes.
And you've said, well, let's differentiate self-worth from self-love. This idea of falling in love with yourself. You know, do you know, in California, some women actually got married to themselves in a big sort of ritual on the beach, and they're dressed up in wedding dresses and things. Because then you can see it, you know, it's part of this, I'm going to marry me.
Mm. I heard a sermon once, some years ago, that you've got to love yourself before you can love other people. So how would you...
Yes, well, that's around, isn't it? You've got to love yourself before. What do people think about that? Can we save that one until a bit later? Can we just leave that hanging there? If I forget, would you come back to it? Yes, Margaret.
When did assertiveness train come in? Because I just remember people talking about that they'd been on assertiveness training, which horrified me. I think I was already very assertive.
Yes. Andrew's laughing here. Assertiveness training was linked to the self-esteem movement, but some would have distinguished it, actually, and said, no, this is more, you don't need to do any inner deep work here. You need to act assertively, and then the inner feelings follow it. So it came more out of a behaviorist school rather than this more person-centered approach. So, you know, instead of saying, look, before we talk about assertiveness, we need to, you know, talk about that relationship with your father, and we need to deal with that, and you need to develop a deeper sense of your own dignity and worth. And out of that will grow an assertiveness. Now, Skinner and behaviorism would say, well, that may be interesting if we've got the time to do all that, but meanwhile, let's just get on and behave assertively, and I will teach you how. And what you'll find is if you behave this way, the feelings will follow, and you'll turn back to your dad and you'll say, I don't care what you think. But you didn't have to work through all the issues. You just learned to behave differently. And that's the difference, of course, between the more intrapsychic models that go digging deep and the behavioral models which say, well, if you've got time for that, okay, but let's get on, change your behavior now. Because that works too. So, yeah. Yes. You've got the mic down on the front row here.
Are there any evident distinctions in terms of like where this self-esteem movement has been growing? Is it kind of across the board in terms of like society? But are there any notable differences in different kind of people groups as to where it's been?
Great question, isn't it? Yes. We're running out of hard data here, you know, and into methodological issues, but there's no doubt it's been the strongest in the USA. That's the culture that most resonates with the whole thing. Western Europe, to some considerable degree. The interesting thing is in Eastern, particularly Japan, it's barely penetrated, that culture. Now, through the internet now, there is a growing individualism in Eastern cultures, as I understand it. But that sense of community, the we-ness, held at bay this. See, what we've done is we've gone from we to me. You know, they're still very much a community, corporate, non-individualistic society. But I think the internet now is getting past that into people's bedrooms where they can begin to see the images that are being posted there and getting drawn into this much more individualistic culture. Good point, though, isn't it? Anyone, any perspectives on Japan and so on? You're Japanese. Okay, so I don't want to put you on the spot. Yes, please.
Thank you. I work for a Japanese company. I was over there last November, I think it was. We were talking about the different cultural norms in each country, just trying to work out better ways of working. And there were a number of things which you would never think about, as you know, you think of Japan being developed and Western. But for example, there's no culture of counselling if something goes wrong with someone. There's just no, they don't talk to people. They don't work it out in that way. And it goes on.
Well, I mean, they're very interesting, these differences, aren't they? And we don't want to stereotype too much or fall into any traps there, but you know, the self-esteem movement certainly doesn't resonate in that culture in the same way as it does in our more individualistic one here. Well, should we go on to our final bit? Because what I want to do in the final bit is try and persuade you that the self-esteem movement, as I've characterized it, in this ill-defined but nevertheless prevalent, highly penetrating culturally movement about valuing yourself, esteeming yourself, being more confident, loving yourself, that sort of ill-defined sort of shifting sand that we still know out there as self-esteem, you've got to love yourself. That kind of cultural change, what I want to try and convince you is there's really little benefit, little evidence of benefit to mental health. And indeed, rather than that, it may actually have been harmful, done more harm than good. Okay, so what I want to convince you is there's little benefit that any of this has helped, that it's delivered the flourishing that it promised. It may indeed have been harmful. And then secondly, I want to finish by trying to convince you that flourishing depends on not simply self-worth, but on self-understanding. And a self-understanding which embeds self-worth in a thicker matrix of meaning and purpose. In other words, worth isn't just out there as some existential statement. Worth is embedded in a self-understanding which addresses the big questions of meaning, who am I, and purpose. What am I for? When we begin to have a richer, thicker understanding of ourselves in that way, we begin to discover reasons for the self-worth, the dignity of the human being that you've touched on, and that we all know in our hearts to link in some way with human well-being and flourishing. So they're the two things I want to try and convince you of. Let's start with the first one. It is surprising how long it took psychologists to really get around to evaluating these linkages, these correlations in a bit more detail. And Roy Baumeister is probably the person who's done the best sort of overview of the literature in this respect. He was commissioned by the American Psychological Association in the late 90s to carry out a major review of this whole area. And Nicholas Emler in the UK has produced a very good overview as well. Jennifer Twenge, an American psychologist, I mentioned more. And what all three of these reviewers have found is that self-esteem is really a significant causal factor. Second, there's no evidence that boosterism delivers the health, educational, social outcomes claimed. And indeed, it's actually quite hard to achieve non-contingent self-esteem. It's quite hard. We're all deeply embedded socially creatures. We find it very hard to detach our sense of self-worth from what's going on around us. So let's look at each of those in turn. This self-esteem really a significant causal factor? Let me show you this study to illustrate it, Bowden 2006 from a New Zealand birth cohort, the Dunedin cohort. What this found, in fact, was a good association between, as we'd expect, earlier measures of self-esteem at age 11, and this was a birth cohort, so they were being followed longitudinally, prospectively. So a few years later, when you visit the same people, and they got fantastic rates of follow-up, this cohort, when you visit the same people, you find higher incidence of risky sexual behaviors amongst those with low self-esteem. Just as we'd expect from what I said at the beginning, there's a strong association between low self-esteem and a range of outcomes. And that's the basis on which we therefore go into schools, into clinics, and try to boost kids' self-esteem, because this will reduce these risky sexual behaviours. They then looked at their data a little more clearly, and they adjusted them for a number of factors, particularly for social class, a history of sexual abuse, IQ, family stability. And when they adjusted their data for these independent variables, they found that self-esteem, its effect, disappeared. In other words, the association between self-esteem and these adverse outcomes is confounded. And it's not a causal factor at all in most cases. And over again, if you look at the data, it's very hard to show that it's actually self-esteem that's causing the outcome, but rather both low self-esteem and the outcome appear to be related to something else. Over and over again, these were the kind of data that emerged. So the causal link between self-esteem is very shakily demonstrated. In fact, it's not well demonstrated at all. The second issue was whether self-esteem, whether attempts to boost self-esteem actually work at all. And Baumeister reviewed all of the trials he could get his hands on. He found very little evidence that where you actually randomized and put the things into a proper control conditions, he found very little evidence that boosting self-esteem works. So just the evidence isn't there. And yet we still often continue doing this. But the evidence really from controlled data is not there. Let me show you this particular one. This was published, was it 2011, I think. And it's from the Hamilton, University of Hamilton, Ontario. And it's quite a nice randomized study. What they did was they took a group of subjects and they randomized them to one of three conditions. The first, they handed them all out those kind of self-affirming statements that I mentioned earlier. You know, the cards with those statements. I am confident. I make a difference. Wherever I go today, I'll impact people. Those kind of things. So that was what they're testing. They were the study, in fact, that showed how often these things tend to be used still, certainly in a North American culture. So they said, let's see whether they work. And so they handed them out. And in this group, they were asked every day for about 30 minutes to have a little sort of selfie quiet time where you meditate on these cards, and they were asked to focus positively on them. What happened in the next group? They were given the same cards and told to meditate on them for half an hour a day and to meditate on how this is true and how this is not true of me. So they had to, it's much more evaluative exercise, you see. The third group were given the cards but told to do nothing at all. What happened 3, then 6 months when we follow these people up? And particularly, what happened to the people in this group? Well, interestingly, the people at the beginning of the study with low self-esteem in this group who got these cards and had to focus, by the end of the study, actually felt worse about themselves. Measures of self-esteem were lower, and a raft of other measures of general well-being, general measures of psychological robustness, were also lower. People already felt pretty good about themselves, felt slightly better after doing this, actually. But the people we're trying to help, the author said, people we're trying to help, self-affirming statements seem to backfire for the people who need them most. Why? They didn't say this, I'm saying this, because it's hard to believe your own propaganda. And that is all this is. And it sounds good to say you love yourself, you say how, you stand up. It sounds good, it has a face validity to it, but in the end of the day, it's your own propaganda. And if you believe that you're actually nothing more than a chance association of atoms cast adrift in the universe for a while, or an evolutionary product, only here because you're surviving, then when you say, I am worthy, person of dignity, deep value, what's that mean? And I think people know this in their heart. So they rehearse these statements, but something in them says, but is this true? Me? On what basis? And really the evidence is, I think, overwhelming that these kind of boosterism exercises really don't do much good. And most schools now are moving on from self-esteem you know, the whole school self-esteem policy. They're moving on into more practical exercises that are attempting to develop a sense of worth that's connected with something deeper, something richer. And the two big ones are resilience exercises or resilience classes, and the other one is character, in which we teach children virtues and the importance of character and see self-worth as being generated out of that matrix of virtue, character. But could this have caused even more harm than good? A number of psychologists, notably Jennifer Crocker, who writes beautifully, easy to read, the other one that I mentioned there, Jean Twenge, and others, have produced a lot of data now, which basically says, look, contingency is really hard to achieve. It's your own propaganda. And what putting self-esteem right on the main road of our human endeavor does, you know, the most important thing in life is love yourself. That's what Whitney Houston said. When you make loving yourself, esteem yourself, the main road, and then you find you can't do that, it drives you back into contingent behaviors. In other words, it drives you back onto the treadmill of achieving more, looking better on Facebook, upgrading your status, doing anything you can to improve your self-esteem, because the self-esteem movement put it at the very center of what it is to be human and what it is about to be human, boosting your self-esteem. And there is our modern dilemma. And it increases contingency. Jennifer Crocker's produced some nice data showing how it reduces empathy. Because if you're so worried about keeping up your self-esteem, it's hard to be worried about other people. We don't have time to demonstrate one or two of those studies. A psychologist called Carol Dweck has shown that the wrong kind of boosterism, what she calls person praise, actually reduces learning and hunger for new information amongst kids, hunger for personal growth. I will tell you a little bit about this. What she did was she took a group of children, and she's done this over and over again, and her book Mindset's a good read. She's a group of kids, and she divided them into two groups, one of her many experiments. And she gave them both a set of relatively easy, but not too easy, tasks. And then their work was marked with them with some primed teachers. And in group A, the teacher gave them person-centered praise. You did well with that. You're smart. I think you're pretty intelligent. Wow, what have we got here? An Einstein or what? Whoa, Mozart in the making. So this is all praise that focuses on the person, you see. The other group, that's group A. Group B got something different. They got effort-focused praise. I like the way you tried at that. Or rather, they wouldn't have said, I like. They said, you tried hard at that. Well done. You're putting a lot of effort into this. Look how you got that. That's nice. Not sure about this bit. Next time we'll perhaps work on that. But you're a trier. If at first you don't succeed, try again. You know that, don't you? And so they're rewarding effort. And so her work is all about the difference between effort praise, person praise, or status praise. What she's found unequivocally is that person praise undermines confidence. Why? Because if you've been told a prince, if you've been told you're a prince, you don't want to discover you're a frog. So you don't try as hard. You choose the easier tasks. And she obviously then tested this by taking the same group of kids and now giving them the choice of how hard they want the next test to be. Easy, medium, hard. And the kids in the effort praise, on average, chose the harder tasks because they want to learn. They're hungry to know about life and to grow. They haven't got something, an image to keep up, a sense of personal status to preserve. The group over here, on average, chose the easier tasks because they don't want to fail, given the status that they've been awarded. I remember somebody bringing this home to me at the end of a schizophrenia conference, it was, and a few of us used to go skiing afterwards because fortuitously it was held up in the mountains. And at the end, a little group of us that had been before went. We went for about 2 or 3 days. And we had a great time. We knew each other well, about 6 of us, about the same level, not threatening to each other. We skied around. One day, we were just having a little rest by the side of the piste, and then down through the off-piste came another group. Through the off-piste, you see. And then they came up, and I recognized they were actually from our conference as they got close. And I could see they were very keen because some of them had helmets on in the days when hardly anybody had helmets. And then I saw a friend of mine was among them. And he said, Glenn, he said, come and join us. He said, we've got a guide. We're going off-piste. Great. We're going off for the day. And I thought for a fraction of a microsecond and then said, no, thanks. Don't. I think I'll stay with friends here, you see. So off they went. And then one of our group turned to the others and he said, interesting, isn't it? Glenn would rather be the best in this group than the average in that. He was a pathologist, can you believe? So, if you think you're a prince, it's hard to discover your frog. So you choose lower challenge tasks. It impedes learning. And self-esteem, which massages ego in this way, makes you special, is a tyranny that we impose on our kids to stand out in a world which actually says fitting in gets you a long way because it's all about teamwork, collaboration, cooperation. So we're in a culture which has become increasingly narcissistic as well. This is Jean Twenge and some of her tracking data in student cohorts through the 80s up until 2006. And this is the narcissistic personality inventory. She's done a massive amount of data analysis here. And you can see over time, students' self-rated narcissistic scores, that is, narcissism, the tendency to evaluate the world in terms of what's in it for me and how it affects me and my image, that sense of narcissism has been progressively increasing among students. Now, as you will tell me, correlation doesn't mean causation, so I can't prove that the whole self-esteem movement lies behind this. And I've no way of doing that, but there's a face validity to it, isn't there? That the two in some way are linked, that this absorption with the self that we've entered into over the last half century has not led to human flourishing in the way that we'd hoped. Yes?
I wonder if you think this is contributing to the growing trend of universities, particularly people want safe spaces where yes. People aren't allowed to express a view that they're uncomfortable with. They won't hear it.
Yes. This is a great point, isn't it? That, you know, are you most of us aware of victim culture now in which there's this sense of my being a vulnerable person, in which my sense of self-worth is quite a vulnerable thing. It's the opposite of contingency, isn't it? It's become, but people like Crocker would say, this is one of the outcomes of this absorption with me, with putting my needs at the center, the main road of my life's ambitions, you know, massaging my ego, feeling good about myself. It's led in some, although other cultural factors have fed into this doubtless, to this sort of fragility of the self, of keeping you up there with the best skiers. And so I mean, it links with a wider political context, doesn't it? But this notion of safe spaces, if you've not heard about it, is particularly in the States, but also here now, is this idea, I must be made safe from hearing things or seeing things that will upset me. And so there's this term trigger warnings. So what you've got to do is issue trigger warnings for vulnerable people. And so, I don't know, you might feel a few trigger warnings were needed here at the beginning, you know, particularly if you say you're a skier or something like that. But trigger warnings are there to protect the vulnerable, whose sense of self-integrity has become so vulnerable in today's culture. Crocker would say that's because we're obsessed with it, with keeping it so safe and secure. Now, just let's say that every culture, every university, every society has to place some limits around what it will tolerate said in public. You know, there has to be some, let's not get into this, but there has to be some exit where we're standing up and saying stuff is discouraged. Limits are placed around it. But here we're talking about really just different views about the nature of life. Sexuality, say, transgenders are the key issues, but particularly race is the big one in the States. So trigger warning, safe spaces, we could see as having been partly fed into, although other factors, by this self-esteem culture. It's a great point, that, actually. So where have we got to? If not achievement, if not status, if not self-worth, where do we get this sense of dignity as a human being? And this brings me back to that very final point that I wanted to make, that value, worth, cannot be separated from self-understanding, particularly what we understand about our meaning and our purpose. These are philosophical issues that go to the nature of what it means to be human. The moral philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, for example, says that there's a close link between worth, value, and purpose. Value is bound up with purpose. It's hard to know what the value of a thing is if you don't know what it's for. And so, for example, if a Martian comes from outer space and I give him a screwdriver, and I said, what do you think that's worth? What's its value? He looks at it, has no idea. It's a piece of metal with some plastic on the end. Has no idea what its value is. But then we go over to a door that actually we've been trying to get through, but it's off its hinges and jammed. And I get him to lift it, and I screw those loose screws back in, and it tightens it. Now I open the door and we walk through. Now he sees the purpose of it, he sees what it's for, and he has some notion of its value. And similarly, I think I'd want to argue that worth, value, needs to be rooted in this matrix of meaning and purpose that links to our philosophy of life. And psychology, science, cannot answer those why questions, as we all know, or at least I hope we do. So where do we get that from? We go to philosophy of life. Jennifer Crocker is not a Christian, secularist. She says we need to now have some sort of bigger picture that we're part of, some sense of purpose and meaning. Now, as a philosopher of life, an everyday philosopher of life, I hear what she says. I'm not sure that it belongs in a scientific paper, which was where I found it. It's a piece of life philosophy, but I think she's right. I think our sense of value does need to be part of a bigger story than me. And she's an environmentalist, and so she argues for becoming an eco-warrior. And she says, if you have a purpose over and above me, you find that self-worth is a byproduct of pursuing that purpose. I generate a sense of dignity and worth as part of this pursuit of this story bigger than me, making the world a better place, living for others, building a safer environment. Those are generative conditions of the human spirit. They lead to flourishing, they lead to self-worth, but not because we put them at the center, but because they're a byproduct of something bigger. And so I think it is possible in non-Christian philosophies of life to develop a sense of dignity. Humanists can do this, and Buddhists perhaps in their own way. There are ways in which different philosophies of life try to feed into this. And I don't want to suggest that that is valueless. But I think there's nothing personally, for me as a Christian, like the Christian worldview in terms of addressing this issue of what is man. Because, of course, our doctrine that man is made in the image of God himself imbues our whole sense of being with immense meaning and purpose. Being made in the image of God tells us that we are loved unconditionally. You can achieve, you can fail. You can get status, you can retire and be a nobody. It doesn't matter. His love is unconditional. And therefore, your sense of worth is grounded in something that isn't shifting sand. It's grounded in God's love. But more than that, this generates a sense of self-understanding in the image of God, which is filled with purpose. I'm here to bear his image well, to make a difference in his world, to exercise my power, my ability to respond to life's challenges because I'm made in his image, empowered by his spirit, loved by him when I mess up. I think that's a profoundly rich self-understanding that we need to be unpacking much more imaginatively than we do. It needs to be an imaginative. We need to start imagining much more what it means to be an image bearer, to make a difference in God's world as people of dignity who reflect his grace and glory. And so, in terms of human flourishing, I know of no better motivation, no better way of delivering that in a way that, besides bringing life to the world, actually also brings life to us. Value, dignity, that sense of worth and confidence. Because, of course, that's the irony of the gospel. Jesus says, seek first the kingdom of God. Seek something outside of yourself, and all these things shall be yours as well. And self-worth actually works like that too. So that's the sort of kind of preachy ending, I'm sorry, but I believe that with all my heart. And one of the wonderful things I've found since retiring is from secular practice, where one works within the worldview of the individual, is I've loved the opportunity to work with people. I don't practice anymore, by the way, so please don't anyone be in touch because I don't practice, but I have been able to work with, in a more explicitly Christian setting, where these realities are there and owned and part of the process. You're an image bearer of God, loved by him, and I find it tremendously fruitful and productive. So, do you know, I think the thing I'd want to say before we go back to questions, of course, is that in John 1, if any of you get the Cambridge papers from the Jubilee Centre, I've just got one coming out with them called Who Am I Today?, which goes to this whole question of identity. And of course, we're in a culture that's we have to make ourselves up, really. That's part of the self project, defining myself now. But in John 1, we read that in the beginning was the Word. You're not alone, God's spoken. And God revealed himself as being full of grace and truth. So he's revealed himself. But then the wonderful thing about John 1 is that he not only revealed who he is, he revealed who we are to us too. For as many as received him, to them gave he authority to become children of God. So the wonder of the gospel is that God not only reveals himself, he reveals who we are. And that, again, creates this matrix of meaning, purpose, which embeds our sense of self-worth. So I think I'll stop there. And should I have stopped a while back? Or have we got some more questions?
I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you very much. And can we just give him a round of applause? Because I think it was fantastic. Okay. As I was listening to you, it's funny, actually. I wanted to just come in. Perhaps we could actually talk about our own situation. So I have to confess that when the subject of Glenn's talk came up, I was a bit kind of, you know, this will really upset some people. And listening to Glenn's talk put me in mind of a particular situation I've been in, I've been struggling a bit with. I play in an orchestra, and I'm a pretty good player, I would say, but I think that really has been getting in the way of, you know, playing as an orchestra member. It's okay when I'm in the orchestra, I'm at the front of the section, but lately I've just joined a big orchestra and I'm right at the back. I think, oh, I should be a bit further forward. And, you know, I'm a really good player and that person is not as good as I am. And this was going on in my head and I knew it wasn't quite right. And it came to head a bit at the rehearsal on Wednesday when the leader said to me, can you just pipe down a bit because it's like a Tina concerto. And, you know, and it's supposed to be quiet at this point and we can only hear you playing. I thought, my goodness. You know, and I was a bit cross about it. I was going, well, it was just because I was frustrated and no one's noticed me and no one's said what a good player I am. You know, all this going in my head. And it really does get in the way. If you're sitting in the orchestra and you're thinking, gosh, I'm such a good player, can someone please praise how good I am? It's a perfect picture, isn't it? Of, you know, the sound of the orchestra, it's about the music, it's about should it be really quiet, pianissimo. You should not be playing forte at that moment just to show how well you can play it. So, personally, I have to say, you have convinced me. So does anyone at this point have a sort of reflections on this and, you know, do we want to take this anywhere else? And I think one question that I was thinking about halfway through was what about the Christian agenda? And I think there's some movements within Christian circles to either, you know, be traditional about it and confess your sins. But there's also this various movements, which I'm sure we've all been part of. I was part of something called Living Free, which I found very helpful. But, you know, if you're sat there and you're actually thinking about your destiny and, you know, God is something great for me, well, you know, that's something I was having to realize with my own career. I would have liked to be a famous scientist. I'm not a famous scientist, but I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I teach, you know, I do this and that, I do Christians in science. So, you know, if we were only thinking of our own personal aggrandizement, you know, you wouldn't be able to find people like Sally to do the tea and you know, and then I think that's maybe exactly, Corky and John doing all the chairs. So, you know, if we're always thinking, you know, me, and, it, you know, the more I listened to Glenn, the more I was thinking, yes, this is actually quite apposite for even how Christians are starting to think. Anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, I fully agree with everything you've said, and yet there are many Christians, I think, who would be able to agree totally with what you've said, and yet their lives are still crippled with lack of self-esteem. Mm. What practically, therapeutically, are the ways in which they can bring together what they know in their head to be true, but what their heart and their lives struggle to acknowledge their doctrine and their faith says to them?
No, it's a great, great question. Thank you. And I often get asked questions like this. And that was very difficult because they're very big questions that draw in lots of possible stories behind them. So I find that I usually won't say, I don't want to hand out bland sort of, you know, patronizing statements, that it's just important to get the person's own story, I think, first. That's the mistake the self-esteem movement did. You know, it says, got all these complicated stories. It all boils down to you just need to boost your self-esteem in that way. But I do take your point. There are lots of Christians. You think, we've got this great news. Why does it have such a marginal effect on us? Why does it take time to work its way through? And I think that's the case with much of what's true about the faith. It takes a while to work itself through, doesn't it? You've just got to keep working at it. And I think our churches haven't been good, as I said, at making this is an imaginative task. I've got to imagine what it means to be an image of, to bear the image of God. What we often say in churches is, you know, your identity isn't in your work, it's in Christ. And we all nod and say yes, and we think we've done something by saying that. And it's true, it's a great theological truth that your identity is in Christ. But it's imaginatively very thin. Well, how does that translate into how I feel about myself tomorrow, you see? Whereas if somebody says, you're made in the image of God, you bear his image. Now, I want you to think, Tina, as you're playing in the orchestra, that you play the cello. This is what God's saying. But, you know, you're playing that cello. You're actually doing it. It's not, this is your work that you're contributing to the life of the world. Music, beauty, it resonates the very glory of God. So you are doing that. But you're doing it in a we kind of way, not a me kind of way. It's part of something that's bigger than me, which actually makes it better still. And I think we've got to unpack being made in the image of God much more imaginatively than we do and in those kind of ways. I often say to people, you've got to let God love you. You know, in personal counseling, I've said that. You've got to let God love you. We find it hard to let him through, you know. Yes. Sorry, there was so much politeness here.
Got to remember why I stuck my hand up now. I have a friend, we're talking about flourishing, and you're talking about the we bear the image of God, and he's a worship leader. But recently he got invited into mental hospitals because people were listening to his songs, which are about letting people know that they are in the image of God and reflecting on that. And he got invited in because the staff who were non-Christian noticed the flourishing in the people there, and I asked him to do a concert, and then some more people responded with good outcomes in their mental health, and he's been invited to about 7 different mental care institutions in those regions, and he's being invited back, and it's because he focuses on these things that you've been describing as where people can be in touch with their meaning and their purpose through bearing the image of God. And I'm really happy that that's happening.
Mm. Of course, even if they don't quite use that language or know what you mean, you're treating them as those who are made in the image of God. And I think that in itself creates its own flourishing, you know. Of course, you know, I'm the kind of Christian, I'd also want to say this is a realistic understanding, and the full gospel is that we are broken images, and that the gospel is about restoring us to our being fully imaging God. But yes, there was one here, I think, then there's one there. Yeah.
So Glenn, I imagine you'd agree that showing appreciation and encouragement is essential if we're to flourish. And yet, where is the line between that and boosterism? And when do we start feeding on that?
Great question.
I mean, you're standing up here, and you'll be very disappointed if people don't say afterwards to you, that was a really good talk.
Yeah.
I know I would.
Yes. And here's the tip. What I try and do in the book, and I'm sorry I'm going to plug, but I haven't got any, but you can get it on... You can get it on Amazon, or you can go to my website, humbly called glennharrison.com, And that gives you a link to IVP where you can get it. But it's very easy on Amazon as well. But go through one of the cheaper ones. But what I try and do there is try and work out the... You're saying, what are the practicalities of this now? Let's dig down a bit deeper. And a key tip is evaluate the action, not the person, you see. Always try and praise the action rather than elevate the person. So, you know, you're terrific. Wow, well, what are you? You know, that kind of language, we fall into it so easily. And kids particularly, they know this. You did incredibly well there. Again, I was looking at some data the other day which shows that if you inflate your praise of kids incredibly well, what a brilliant, even if you inflate your effort praise, they know it wasn't incredible. They know that, actually, so be realistic in your praise. So I think the tip is rate or evaluate the specific action, and particularly the effort behind it. And I think, too, the gospel very much affirms that we need to take ownership of what we've done. And if it's gone well, take the pleasure in that thing, and if it hasn't, learn the lessons. But again, it's in the thing itself, you see. So, I don't like this thing, it wasn't me, it was the Lord talk. We do everything in the strength of the Lord, but this, it wasn't me, it was the Lord. You know, I mean, have you heard the story of the guy who goes up to the guy playing the piano in church, and he says, thank you so much, that made such a difference, the service. It was a really beautiful piece of music, organ playing, thank you. And the guy looks humbly and says, oh, it wasn't me, it was the Lord. And you think, wasn't that good, actually. You know, I mean, the Lord did it. I mean, if it was the Lord, who played the wrong note then, you know? And then what he says then is, oh, well, I played the wrong note. And what kind of a father would want for his children? He gets all the right notes, and you get all the wrong notes. That is a recipe for a negation of the image of God that we bear. The whole basis of God saying, well done, good and faithful servant, is that he recognizes your responsibility in having done that. And he rewards it. And so I want to take full ownership. So let's take this talk. I take full ownership of what I've done. If you say to me, thank you very much, I'll think, yes, and here's the other trick that I do there. I think I'm so grateful for that. Coming from Andrew, who's a bit of a stickler, that would be extra. He hasn't said it, I know. But I'm just, and we know this is all hypothetical, because he is a bit of a stickler. But if he happened to say that, I actually have a little trick there, just to keep it separate from me. But he doesn't know how I spoke to my wife earlier. Or it's just one part of what I am. So whilst that allows me to evaluate how I do at Christian Science events and what I can learn about the future, it actually doesn't say anything about me as a child of God and how much I'm loved and that basic sense of dignity and worth. So I keep that as non-contingent. Okay? But the specific competences are always improving or declining as I get older and so on. And we all have to grapple with how we bear the image of God and contribute to life for the world. But that sense of inner worth and dignity, that is impregnable because it's held in God's love. You've got to imagine, you've got to imagine that. And that's why I suggest these little tips and tricks for doing that and building confidence in that way. Yes. Was there anybody else? We can get the... Yes, there's one over there as well in a minute.
Just on that, I just remember the story of about a vicar who saw this fellow working on a most beautiful garden, and he went along and he said, well, you and the Lord have really made a good job of that garden. And he said, you should have seen it last year when the Lord had it to himself.
Yeah. That's very good, actually. Very good.
Yeah,
and actually, it's a beautiful example of what bearing God's image means, because the whole point of the story of the Garden of Eden is God creates the eggs, as it were, but he says, now you make the omelettes. Yeah. Well, he creates the garden, but he says, now you tend it. Mm. And we as humans do actually bear God's image. And we do make omelettes, and we do make a difference as we bear it.
Yeah.
It's so important to feel
that. Just one other thing I was thinking is, I know when I first became a Christian, after about 2 weeks, I remember being absolutely shocked that I was still doing things wrong. And I was kneeling on, I know it is shocking, and I was kneeling on my bed, and I just said, Lord, I know that you love me, but I'm still sinning. And I said, please just forgive me and cleanse me. And I was just filled with an incredible sense of the love of God just absolutely flooding me. And while, in one way, I was just overwhelmed with his love for me, in a sense, it took all the attention off myself. Mm. And I remember going out the next day, and everybody I saw, I loved as a result of that love that he had for me. And I think, you know, this whole thing, if there's an emphasis on self all the time, it's actually the essence of sin, really, when you think about it. You know, because the story of Adam and Eve is, you know, think about how you can become so well educated,
yes,
and you will understand, and you will be like God, and you will be this, and you will be the other. And that is actually the essence of sin. And I think it's taking the attention off yourself. And that's, to me, where self-worth comes in, is I see my worth in the way God sees me, not the way I see myself.
Yes.
And that's what gives me worth. And I think in that sense, it is very, very strong. But a concentration on how fantastic I am,
yes,
is the very antithesis of that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Tina, do you want to finish? We should finish, haven't we? It's 9:10.
There's just
one question here.
I was just going to make a comment myself. Part of that. I mean, the reason I, part of the publicity for this talk, I put up that, I don't know if you've shown that cartoon I sent.
Yes.
Yeah. So the problem, of course, is that, you know, if we now just weigh in and say, look, the answer to self-esteem is, you know, that can get parodied, and they can just say, well, you know, you're just Christians, really, it's all about kneeling on the floor and, you know, repent, and, you know. But we have to almost sort of stick to our guns on that and maybe make it more nuanced and argue it, as you say, but in a sort of resilient way, and as sort of listening to different stories. And, what do you think about, I mean, how is one to present, if you like, if you want this sort of particular message, if you like, how does one start to kind of unpick?
Yeah, well, that's a huge question. I might just leave it hanging here, if I might, only because everyone may not have remembered the cartoon, and we'd have to sort of try and unpick it a bit. But if you go to it, it's quite funny. It's a Dawkins cartoon, and basically it's a parody of the fatherhood of God. So it's a straw man. It's a classic straw man. It sets up a straw man and then tells us we're ridiculous for believing it. So I think the way we do it is we say, but yes, if that's your God that you don't believe in, that's fine, but this is my God that I do, and it's not that one there that you don't believe. So I think we've got to, again, paint a more convincing, actually just a more truthful image of God. But we can't get drawn into a self-esteem endeavor that is all about feel good, because he's God of justice, and the reality of our being is we need redemption. So, you know, that has to be part of it as well. I think there was one here, but yes, just here, and then one at the back. But to finish, yeah, we'll call it a day after the one at the back.
Two things. You've talked about an experiment where they were divided into three groups, and one had positive affirmations, one evaluated, and the third did nothing. Just curious about the results of the other two groups. And the other thing is where Jesus commands us to love our neighbour as we love ourselves. So there's an implicit command to love ourselves in that. I'm just wondering what your reflection was on that.
Yes, I think it's a that's a big sort of contextual thing as well. I think it's about loving yourself, having the same attitude. It depends what you mean by love, I think.
What did Jesus mean by it?
Well, I think Jesus meant that what you need to do is your defaults are to take care of yourself. That's the way you function as a fallen human being. I'm calling you something higher than that. Love others in the same way that you default to thinking about yourself. That's what I think you were saying. I do think there's a, within the Christian tradition though, a place for what I call self-kindness. I don't like self-love because this generates this sense of absorption with oneself, romance and so on. But I think there's a case for self-kindness, which is, you know, many of the things we struggle with are not sin. They're more character. They're the bits of us to do with the way we are, really, and the bits we struggle with. And they're not sin. It's just that we end up upsetting people when we say the wrong thing, or don't read situations, or talk too much, or spend too long answering questions, you know, this kind of thing. So it's not, and I think being kind on yourself says, well, hang, you know, he's your father. He knows that, you know, we all struggle. We've all been dealt a hand of genetics that we struggle with. So give yourself, you know, keep going. C.S. Lewis said that. He knows what kind of a tough car you're trying to drive. And one day he'll throw it on the scrap heap and give you a new one. And then you will surprise us all because you learned your lessons in the hard school of life. I think that's what he says, and it's a wonderful quote. And it's saying, don't be hard on yourself because God isn't hard on you. But I don't think actually that's what's being said in the text you quoted. I think he's just saying the default is look after me. Now I call you something higher, look after others. There are theologians here, so I... Last question there.
Really a question.
Comment, comment.
We missed the bit because we were stuck on the motorway. We've come up from Swindon. Do you think in some ways that the self-esteem movement is a product of increasing secularism?
Great question. In fact, the best thing to do would be listen to the tape if it's posted, because someone asked this earlier. And I think this lot would be totally bored out of their mind now if we went over it. But there are indeed very interesting strands of postmodernism we identified, radical individualism that's partly fueled by postmodernism, also by consumerism. And these work together in 60s culture to, you know, create very fertile soil for the whole growth of the self-esteem movements, which told us folks that science proved it, you know, that loving yourself was right. And I suppose the best place to end up on is just how little sometimes science can prove if we don't ask the right questions of it. You know. So I'll hang on.